Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Please also find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Tooman, professor of political and legal communications at San Francisco State University and political analyst for CBS Television here in San Francisco and your moderator for tonight's program. It's now my great pleasure to introduce our two distinguished speakers tonight. To my direct left, Dr. Thomas Mann, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and to my far left, Dr. Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. These two fine scholars are co-authors of the new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. I should add in mentioning both of these gentlemen that they will talk about themselves tonight, and with the first question I'll ask them a little bit later. They are people who have worked with each other for many years. Their experience with one another, I think, as they'll describe it, goes back to, I believe, graduate school at the University of Michigan. They are people who are perceived as being on opposite sides of ideological or policy discussions. I'll have them talk about that tonight. But they are both, I think, no surprise to any of you, very, very well known, two of the finest scholars and political scientists, I think, working today in the United States, and also two individuals as academics who have also kept one foot in politics, always, I think they would say, with an emphasis on nonpartisanship and with an emphasis as well on policy. Tonight they'll be talking about the book that I mentioned before, and I'm going to turn this program over to them for some comments before we go to questions.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Joe, and thank all of you for being here. I'm not going to talk so much about the substance of the book. I want to talk a little bit about why we wrote it. First, let me note, Tom and I actually met now 45 years ago at the University of Michigan, and we have been friends since, and we've been partners in a whole series of projects and books over more than four decades, during which time we've been immersed in the politics in Washington, both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, but particularly in the corridors of Congress. And we wrote this book because in the more than four decades that we have been there, we haven't seen it this bad. And believe me, we've seen some bad times. We've seen dysfunction in Washington. When we first arrived, the city as the country were riven down the middle by the Vietnam War, and the passions were high. I remember distinctly a moment in our first year there. We were both working on Capitol Hill as congressional fellows of the American Political Science Association, George McGovern on the floor of the Senate taking his own chamber to task for the war and saying, "The walls of this chamber reek with blood," which brought a collective gasp. He didn't talk that way. A short while later, Bob Dole, then a freshman senator, took to the floor and just ripped the bark off of McGovern. But before that year was out, I saw the two of them walking arm in arm in the corridors of the Senate. They forged a friendship which remains to this day, both of them now in their upper 80s, over the issue of hunger. They shared a passion for dealing with the problem, coming at it from very different perspectives, but it wasn't unusual to find those kinds of relationships, just as the divisions over Vietnam were not partisan ones. Some of the strongest supporters of President Nixon's approach to Vietnam were Southern conservative Democrats. Some of the strongest opponents were moderate liberal Republicans, many of them from right out here on the West Coast. The world has changed since then. And for all of the difficulties that era, of course, was succeeded by the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and then you could move forward to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. But now the level of polarization, partisan and ideological, the tribalism that we have, that's not just in Washington, but has metastasized out to the states and is starting to leach into the public in a way that may erode a center that remains there, but that we virtually lost in Washington, alarmed us enough that we wanted to issue a kind of clarion call. We've written a number of books that have either lamented, as the last one, and we discussed it here at the Commonwealth Club 6 years ago, The Broken Branch, the loss of the regular order in Congress. And we focused on both parties and the culpability that both had in different ways for this problem, as we have over time. We have been passionate crusaders, but mostly on process issues. This time, having spent 40 years building reputations in part as people without axes to grind, not pushing for one party or for a particular ideology, we built a lot of capital and felt it was time to spend some of that capital. And while we see a larger structural problem, something we talk about as having parliamentary parties that are now far apart, internally cohesive and oppositional, but one party has been much more culpable of late, and it's what we refer to as asymmetric polarization. We're going to take some heat for that, and it's going to be a little difficult for us in the future to be out there and have the same credibility across the board. But we felt it was necessary because the stakes are so high. And it's not just that we have dysfunctional politics and an inability to come together and a kind of tribalism where the ideas don't matter so much as who's expressing them. If they're for it, we're against it. And in fact, there is significantly more common ground in a whole host of areas than the conventional wisdom would suggest. But we face a set of problems in the country, short-term and long-term, severe enough now that this isn't just something where we can sit, lash ourselves to the mast figuratively and wait for it to pass, or just hope that things will get better. And we're hoping that this book will have enough resonance that it will become a part of the larger conversation in the campaign. And we'll talk about some of the solutions as we talk about some of the culpable areas, but that includes voters. And voters have to understand their own responsibility. And if they simply go after people who pop up and say, I'm not like the rest of those clowns, I don't have anything to do with politics, it's only going to make matters worse. We need people who understand how you can make institutions work, how you can compromise, how you can collaborate in a political process that makes it necessary if you're going to implement painful change. And if we can accomplish even a small portion of that goal, we'll feel satisfied.
Well, thank you all for coming. I'm delighted to be back here at the Commonwealth Club. I certainly have enjoyed my previous appearance here. Everything is a little different. Last time I felt calm. We were speaking sort of soberly, analytically, in our typical fair and balanced way, and we all got along just fine. And now we've said some things that have proved to be really quite controversial. But more than controversial, I have to tell you, we've just had this extraordinary reaction. We wrote a piece in the Washington Post Outlook section that was put online 3 days before it ran in the Sunday section and about 5 days before the official pub date for our book. It was a summary of one feature, one piece of the argument that we make in the book. We had a very clever editor of the Outlook section who gave it a title, let's just say it, the Republican Party is the problem. Well, that piece went viral. I mean, it was the most extraordinary experience we have ever had. Within 24 hours, the Washington Post online stopped counting their comments because at 5,000, they stopped, and we had every reason to believe that it was many times that number. You know, we put a little pressure on their servers at the Washington Post. I learned what it means to go viral. That means if you get 50,000 Facebook likes or recommendations, well, we're at 244,000 and counting, and 3,000 tweets. It's been picked up in the blogs. We've lived and worked in Washington, but never have we found something we've said or written the focus of argument and attention, and always preceded by the widely respected and fair-minded, nonpartisan Manon Ornstein. And it meant that people really just couldn't dismiss it as part of the partisan rhetoric that poisons our politics. They took it seriously. We haven't had one Republican elected official, to my knowledge, speak out on the record, sort of denouncing what what we have said. And I want to tell you, we've had hundreds of emails from people, some really long and thoughtful and poignant. 90% plus were positive. We got some hate mail, but it wasn't much. And many were self-identified Republicans who were so distressed about what had been occurring within their own party, and a desire for someone to break through to change a dynamic in which there's no opportunity in many respects to indicate that frustration. They watch the coverage in Washington, and what they see is either a crossfire show, someone screaming on the left and someone screaming against them on the right, and this makes everything seem fair, or intensely partisan news outlets. And then our traditional news organizations, print and broadcast, fearful of being charged with political or partisan bias, sort of find the norm of balance. Well, you get a quote from someone here and someone there, and that sort of does the story. You know, someone made the comment, Norm, one of the most underreported and least understood transformations in American politics has been that of the Republican Party over three decades, but then over the last 3 and 4 years. And it just hasn't been there because the professional norms of the press, combined with the enormous pressures put on by editors and producers and others, has led to a formulaic style of reporting. Mind you, many of these reporters are our dear friends, and we have enormous respect for them. I want you to know a good number have written to us by email and told us this. You're right. You nailed it. Now you've given us something to talk about in the newsrooms to try to at least make an effort to break through this. But it's been an extraordinary experience. The first assumption on someone hearing it is, now the Democrats have gone crazy and are putting all the blame on the Republicans. I mean, we know they're both to blame. As Norm said, you could do nothing more to enervate, to demobilize, to disarm the public concerned about dysfunctional politics than to say everyone's implicated. They're all the same. They all do it. There's nothing we can do. And if we do it, it's just a sort of visceral, let's throw the bums out. Well, we're making an argument more is required of all of us. We have to understand a little bit more about the dynamics of our political system to know what's going on. We need to ask some questions. We talked about the Republicans as being an insurgent outlier, really a radical party. Why are we saying that? Well, in some respects, they don't now accept what the framers intended, which was a collaboration to try to deal with the problems that face the country. That's why they separated all of these powers. Someone couldn't get along like in a parliamentary system. But they don't believe in that kind of collaboration now. Even rank and file Republicans overwhelmingly say, don't compromise, stand by your principles. And then they say the principle is, you know, we got to deal with these deficits and debt, but the solutions have nothing to do with solving that problem. I mean, if you're in a hole and you have deficits, do you keep digging by cutting taxes first? Is that the way to? No, that's because you believe in low taxes. That's okay. That's a position for you to take, but don't tell us it's something that it's not. I mean, that's just the beginning of the exercise that we have to go through. It doesn't mean Democrats are angels or perfect, but it does mean we've got a set of problems on our hands. And I'll leave you with this. The sort of two basic themes of the case are as follows. One is the mismatch between our contemporary political parties and our governing system. We have parliamentary-like parties, as Norm said, ideologically pretty coherent, individually polarized between them, and vehemently adversarial, thinking strategically all the time, each day, how do we get those guys and advance our chances to claim power? They're parliamentary-like. That's what parties are over in Britain and so on. But we have a set of governing institutions that don't allow majorities to rule. The filibuster in the Senate and its routinization is only one piece of that. So when you run into the clash between the nature of the parties and the nature of the governing system, you got big governing problems. And the second is what we've been discussing, the fact that one of our parties doesn't really believe in legitimacy, and the other doesn't believe in working with the other, really wants to renegotiate 100 years of economic and social policy in the name of dealing with a crisis of deficits, which began reappearing in 2002 after they had been turned into surpluses. So it's a crazy political conversation that's going on that has almost nothing to do with the nature of our political dysfunctions. And our hope is that this book will change the conversation.
Let me just add a couple of quick comments to follow on, Tom. And some of it is just what's happened in the last week or 10 days that reinforces everything that we have written. If you look at what happened in Indiana with Dick Lugar's defeat by Richard Murdoch, and not just the comments that Murdoch has made since, basically saying, I don't believe in compromise. Compromise is where they come over to us, and if they don't, then we need to get rid of them and just elect more of us. But that campaign, a good part of the thrust was condemning Lugar because he had worked hand in glove with President Obama. They neglected to say what it was that they'd worked together on, which was ridding the world of loose nuclear weapons and materials that otherwise would fall in the hands of terrorists. If that's something to be condemned, then we've got even bigger problems. And it's a theme now played out in races all across the country. Today, there were a number of stories on the news about a very hotly contested Senate primary in Florida. And one of the candidates, Connie Mack, is attacking his rival, George Lemieux, because in his brief time in the Senate, he actually worked with Democrats. We don't want to remove the Republican Party or destroy the Republican Party. We want a vibrant, important party that can be there competing with Democrats. This isn't about ideology. Richard Lugar is no moderate. He's a very conservative fellow by his voting record. Bob Bennett, who lost in Utah, was one of the five most conservative in voting records. The difference is they were problem solvers, and now we're leeching out the problem solvers. And then you look at Speaker Boehner saying that they were going to use the debt limit yet again for hostage taking. You know, this is the full faith and credit of the United States. We've had political games played with it over many years. It's crazy to have a separate vote on the debt limit. But the leaders always knew there were games, and they were never going to let the full faith and credit of the United States be jeopardized. Now it is clear, as Senate Leader Mitch McConnell has said after the first debacle, this is now going to be a regular football for hostage taking. You know, it's not as if we have the strongest economy and can weather these storms. You're playing with the future of the country in a way that we just haven't seen.
Okay. Thank you for those, by the way. If you have questions, keep sending them up, and I'll be categorizing them. By the way, for our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speakers are political scientist extraordinaire Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution and Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, who are discussing how to eliminate political gridlock and dysfunction in American politics. Gentlemen, before I come to some of these questions, I thought I would go back and reinforce one of the things you mentioned in your introduction and encourage you to talk about yourselves just for a second, since you were describing your careers. Mm-hmm. For those of you who haven't read it, they haven't talked about the book very much. They don't actually spend the whole book attacking the Republican Party creating this asymmetrical problem. That was what an editor suggested to them, and that's sort of, I think, the news narrative has focused on that. The book actually discusses the problems, but then the meat of the book is about the solutions and our suggestions to voters. And they haven't really, I hope that they will tease some of those answers out when we get into that. One of the things that makes them credible in making this particular argument for the book is the fact that the perception of the public, I think, is that you come at this from different places, either in terms of policy or ideology, certainly in terms of the perception of your affiliations with your employers, right, the American Enterprise Institute and Brookings. And so my question to you that maybe you could describe for the audience is, are you really different at this point, or are you actually, not just in terms of process, do you come, have you sort of gravitated towards one another in terms of your views of policy and ideology as well? Because if you are different, then you've made a powerful statement, obviously, to politicians that if two people who are different in academia can work on this, why can't people who are different in politics as well?
I'm uncomfortable with the question in some ways, and in the sense of the difference being essential. You know, that once again, we need to take someone on the right and on the left, and if they reach the same agreement, there must be something there. I think you're right. Our institutions are different. Brookings is not a left-wing organization. It's a very sort of centrist, nonpartisan institution with plenty of Republicans on the staff who worked in Republican administrations. But I suppose there's a certain progressive orientation among many of the people there. But I directed and now am a senior fellow in the governance studies program, and our job is to understand the process and the intersection of process and policy making. I mean, I'm a citizen, you know, I vote, I'm registered to vote. You can go check my voting records in Bethesda, Maryland and see which party I'm identified with. You can look back on my resume and see I've had experience doing polling and other things. But for 40 years, I've built a career being an analyst of American politics and the constitutional system. And that's what's driven me, and that's why working alone and with Norm over all these years, we've been listened to by people on the Hill, on both sides of the aisle. We'll see. Maybe that'll happen less now because there's a tribalism out there, and if we've shown ourselves to be unworthy of being a member of one of the tribe, that may not happen. But I think I would say what unites us is bigger than what separates us. There's a certain moderation in our whole orientation, and I hope an honesty and integrity in the way in which we go about our work.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I would add, I mean, it is the case that our different institutional identifications have worked to our advantage in many of the projects that we've done. We've done projects on campaign finance reform, on election reform, on reforming Congress inside, and having them as AEI Brookings or Brookings AEI projects gives us more cachet out there. This is not a completely new phenomenon that people look at where people are and assume that they're spinning it in some way. And so we've been able to avoid some of that. But I also think, you know, we rise or fall on the quality of what we've said. And in some ways, the difference in identification has helped us because it's gotten people to read what we've said or listen to us a little bit differently. And I found this in so many audiences, that if you go to an audience of conservatives and they think you're a liberal, they don't listen to you, and vice versa. If you go to an audience of conservatives and they think you're one of them, you can say the same things you would say if they thought you were a liberal, and they'd say, yeah, that's just crap, and they'll nod their heads. So, you know, it's something, many things. This new book by Jonathan Haidt, The Righteous Mind, is just a wonderful look by a psychologist at the different mindsets that people of different orientations have. But the fact is, through all of that, we are moderates. We have really tried to reach a goal wherever we've spoken, where people will come up afterwards and say, I'm not sure where you're coming from. And that we've succeeded in that. And we are now not going to be able to do that quite as much, even though we haven't changed. But we're doing it, and we're going to pay a price for it, I think, in some ways, for the reasons that we both said, that you can't stand by idly now and just let this go on. And, you know, we got from the Washington Post piece a lot of liberal blogs that started out by saying, well, we've been saying that for years, and nobody paid attention to us. And I think the reason that this went viral, and, you know, Tom first went to get antibiotics. He thought, tech-savvy, not entirely. But it was an emperor has no clothes moment, yeah. Because it came from people who started without that sense of, oh, we dismiss it right off the bat. So that's what we've done.
Joe, I was wrong. I said I didn't like the question, and I like the question.
Well, I'm glad. Well, let me jump from that then, and we'll start taking the questions from the audience, into one more point. Yeah. Much of your book focuses, I mean, many of your examples are national and focused on the Congress and, to a lesser extent, I think, on the presidency. I'm reminded in you describing your relationship with one another, which goes back over several decades, that there are members of Congress, prominently in terms of this odd couple kind of relationship, Orrin Hatch and Teddy Kennedy, for example, right. Who became good friends even though they were ideologically yeah. or on certain policy ways opposite. They had longevity in Congress. And time to develop a relationship which then allowed for collaboration and partnership and the like to help one another, even if in front of the cameras they had to say things that might come off as taking partisanship or whatever. We don't have a lot of that right now in the House of Representatives, it seems to me. Can you describe from your writing in the book what you think might be a solution towards increasing opportunity to develop those kinds of relationships? And as a secondary question, if we also extrapolate this from the federal now to the state levels, in those states that have imposed term limits in legislative bodies, like here in California, if you're in the state assembly, 3 2-year terms is all you get. Can we have those kinds of relationships that allow for that collaboration and allow for functionality, not dysfunction?
There's a lot to talk about here, but why don't I just first take a crack at a chapter that we call Bromides to be Avoided. First, do no harm. It seemed to us that all of the energy going into efforts to deal with dysfunctional government tend to attach themselves to ideas that aren't very promising and could actually do more harm than good. One of those was the idea of a third-party independent presidential candidate, and Americans elect, may it rest in peace, which closed its books today, was a source of some of this effort, and we dealt with this when we wrote this book in the fall and winter very, very critically. It just didn't offer a way out, and it was likely to do more harm than good. It wasn't clear thinking in terms of building on what the problem was and how such a candidacy would likely make a difference. Similarly, a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, to an amendment to limit terms. These are really terrible ideas. We have examples from the states. I mean, do we really want to carry California rules on budgets and taxes to the whole country? I mean, you are a model for dysfunctional fiscal policy. God knows. They like it. They like it.
Now, no pandering to the audience here, right?
Anyways, the first thing is to stay away from foolish ideas. Now, there's also the idea prominent among academics. Relax. We've been through tough times. Pre-Civil War, yeah, that's a nice period to compare ourselves to. And it'll adjust over time. Just be calm. Now, we think that's that's irresponsibly complacent because things are so much different. The one big thing that many people rally to is let's get all private money out of politics and fund our elections publicly. Well, maybe it would work, but I know we can't get it because of the nature of our Constitution and how it's interpreted by the courts, and especially the Roberts court. It can't happen. Mind you, if a constitutional amendment becomes the source of a social mobilization of citizens deeply concerned about our politics, fine. Just don't expect it, to keep all private money out of politics, and B, that if you do that, it's going to change everything dramatically. There are just many forces operating in our politics. We need to reform money in politics, and the book is filled with suggestions for doing it, but full public financing cannot work in an era of super PACs and in an era in which the courts rule that you cannot limit expenditures in American politics. Okay,
so let me talk for just a minute about the term limits issue, because
yeah.
I think it relates to a broader problem in the society, which is this yearning for people who are not politicians. And if you just purge the system of politicians, you know, to use the old joke, if the framers were alive today and heard that, they'd be rolling in their graves. and they were politicians. They understood that you want people who respect the institutions that are political institutions, who work within a set of rules and boundaries that are the regular order, and you've got to understand other people's points of view, put yourself in their shoes. That's why we created a Congress, which comes from the Latin word to come together, and not a parliament, which is from the French word parler, to speak. The idea in this extended republic was you were going to bring people together, they would see each other, talk to each other, understand each other, and then work together. And even if they didn't agree on things, they would come together enough and discuss and deliberate enough that people would believe the legitimacy of the decisions that were made. Term limits work against that at every level. You don't bring in the kinds of people who have commitment to institutions or longer-term things. You want to make the big splash now and then move on to the next office or to the lobbying job that you're going to get. You take away all institutional memory. Now, your example of Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy, which is a wonderful example that we have used over many years, and for 20 years, Orrin Hatch wouldn't give a talk or meet with a group of people without talking proudly about his relationship with Ted mm-hmm. Kennedy. This will tell you all you need to know about our contemporary politics. He's running for re-election. He saw what happened to Bob Bennett, his colleague, 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. The two words that will not pass Orrin Hatch's lips through this year are Ted and Kennedy. That's gone. It's death in his state if he starts to talk about how he collaborated with Ted Kennedy. The things they collaborated on now, he's getting great distance from. This is not about Orrin Hatch. It's about a new climate. Now, one of the things that we have championed for a long time, and it continues to be there, and it is, they're still dealing with human beings, it is much easier to demonize somebody you don't know. And the better you know them, the harder it is to do so. Most members of Congress, and the House especially, come there now. They leave their families back home. Every single freshman did that. They spend as little time in Washington as they can. They don't get to know each other. It used to be that the families were there, they'd spend weekends there, and they'd be on the sidelines of soccer games or baseball games with spouses and with the kids. You're not going to go out and call somebody a communist or a socialist if you had dinner with them or you were there, and that doesn't happen anymore. So we've advocated, for example, in Congress, a different schedule. 3 weeks in Washington, 1 week off where you could go back home and, you know, keep in touch with the base. And by the way, a little corollary to that, during the 15 days, 5 days a week, 9 to 5, so it's not 3 days or 2 days, no fundraising. So you're not spending every spare minute running off the Capitol to raise money. You still have 15 days to do that. And that would help. And if you could find other incentives to get people to move their families there, it would help. But I think the Hatch-Kennedy example now tells us that we've got a deeper cultural problem. This is now so tribal that you can imagine, look at the former Yugoslavia. You can live next door to people and be neighbors and be friends for 30 years, you get into tribal warfare and, you know, you'll say to your own tribe, hey, it's them, take them away. It becomes much more difficult. So we've got to deal with this at root levels, and modest changes are really important, but we can't kid ourselves that we're going to solve the problem by just letting people spend more time together.
Okay, so thank you. Very thoughtful answers for both of you. Apropos of that, a block of questions came through that I'm going to synthesize for those of you who asked these questions about, and this will maybe give you an opportunity to talk about, outline some of your solutions from the book for people who haven't had a chance to read it yet. Because a lot of your advice, I think, is geared towards not just educating but motivating voters. Many people ask, what can an average voter do to change this dysfunctionality? Do you want to outline some of your solutions as directed towards voters on this?
One of our chapters looks at what we can do at the level of our elections to produce sort of less intensely polarized, tribalistic parties. And we have a number of ideas. One is to maximize citizen participation in the elections. It turns out if you have a 90-95% turnout as opposed to 50-55 or lower in midterm elections, you get to the polls peoples who don't have as searing sort of a set of beliefs and who tend to be a little more open to someone who's willing to talk to a member of the other party. So we have lots of ideas, some really radical, including mandatory attendance at the polls. The Aussies do it, by God. They have since 25. Producing...
You see, they don't agree on everything.
Producing turnout above 90% in every election since then. It's just, it's amazing. It changes the conversation. Instead of mobilizing and demobilizing efforts, keeping those people from getting to the polls and being able to vote, it's really addressing broader audiences and talking about more substantive problems. We have lots of ideas on that side of things, but there are other ways, even electoral reforms, changing the way in which we redraw districts. Gerrymandering is not the source of all of the problem, but it now exacerbates it. It makes these tribalistic parties even more tribalistic, and so changing that process, as California has done this time around, offers some promise. Open primaries, as California has. See, you do innovate in some constructive areas. You know, it's not all bad, and there are some sort of hopeful tendencies.
You've gone from an F to a D now. You're moving in the right direction here in California. So, you know, in part the question is, what can individuals do? And naturally, if you're out there and you're dismayed by this, you're thinking, what can I do to help? And it's not an easy thing, but what we have to do is to get voters to look at the world in a different way and behave in a different fashion. A part of it is, if somebody pops up and says, I'm not like the rest of those clowns, don't listen to that. Look for problem solvers. Focus on trying to get candidates whose whole orientation is towards understanding that there are problems and that you've got to work with others to solve those problems. A second part of this is, don't believe every negative ad. Negative ads dominate this process because they work. And they work because there is an automatic assumption that they're all a bunch of scoundrels. And we've got to guard against that, so we need a little bit of that. And then in a more general sense, we really do need voters to mobilize to help us make some of these changes. Most people are not engaged in reforming the process. It's boring. It's not something they spend a lot of time focused on. But we can't just do this with a bunch of people at the elite level. You've got to get some backing for it, whether it's changing the election system. Mandatory voting is a steep uphill battle in a country where we don't like mandatory anything. And I think it's going to happen at some point when people come to realize that if we have politics dominated by a sliver of voters who represent the bases, that it's not going to work. And I just want to emphasize one of the things that Tom said. It's not that we want people to vote because we'll feel better if we have more voters. 95% turnout in and of itself is not such a wonderful thing. The former Soviet Union had that all the time. It didn't represent function in the system. Chicago gets to 110% on a good day.
Vote once, vote twice. Yes. Okay.
The difference is, now I'm going to get Louisianans saying, what about us? The difference is, as Australian politicians of all stripes will tell you, that if you're not in a system that's driven by the bases, and the Karl Roves of the world are all focused on activating their base by scaring the living daylights out of them and then suppressing the other side's base. If you can move away from that, and politicians know your base is going to be there, almost all of them. Their base is going to be there, almost all of them. So you focus on the voters in the middle. And what it does is it changes the conversation, as Tom said. You don't talk about guns or gays or abortion. You talk about jobs and education and the economy and the climate and the big things that matter. You don't use terrible language as much because that may motivate your base, but it turns off the voters in the middle. And getting back to the question of how you can keep people from being disillusioned and dismayed by this, the reason that we want to see something like this happen is if you can change that conversation and voters come to believe that politicians actually are intent on trying to figure out how to solve those problems, then you're likely to get a greater level of interest and a sense of efficacy about the system.
So to that last point, voter apathy, which I think you indirectly talk about in the book, a way of curing that is to change the conversation. This would engage people more. And maybe a law that mandated everybody had to participate, if you could get that through, might do the same. One of the other things that you talk about in the book, and I'd like you to address for the audience tonight in a short way if possible, is campaign finance reform. Money is more important, I think, than ever. And as you mentioned in your book, super PACs and then the independent expenditure committees, which are not supposed to be connected to candidates, but invariably they are now, because of the most recent Supreme Court decision, and an earlier decision, Buckley versus Valeo, which makes giving money a form of free speech, money's more important than ever, usually to buy those negative advertisements you were just talking about. If we increase voter participation, but we don't address money, won't money's influence be even more pernicious than before?
Well, part of the answer to that is we don't do just one thing. There is no silver bullet. We've got to work on a whole host of things. We were reminded this morning, for those looking at New York Times and story or online, of this extraordinary account of a proposal to a Republican conservative billionaire who has his own super PAC to set up a campaign of associating Barack Obama with the Reverend Right. And there were sort of racial dimensions to it. But all in all, it was one of the most disgusting things. But it's perfectly, those are normal conversations in groups of campaign strategists. This goes on all the time. At the very least, we'd like to be able to have a system in which many people participate in the financing of them through reasonably small donations, and in which you don't set yourself up for some very wealthy person waking up one morning and saying, you know, I think I'm going to write a check for $100 million to this group that promises to go out and, A, destroy this candidate running for president or this party seeking to ensure that my favorites are in the majority in the House or the Senate. I mean, think about that. This, George Will would say, is free speech, and any effort to constrain it in any way does more harm to the system. So, I mean, we have an agenda of changes on the money side that tries to attack now the flight from disclosure, the utter fraud of so-called independent spending activities. Okay. These are important. We have to deal with it. We have to get more individual donations, and we have ideas for doing that as well. But I don't think it's simply the overall amount of money. It's power. You know, it's difficult reaching a huge nation like ours of people who are busy in their lives and don't pay much attention to politics. So a lot of money in and of itself is not a bad thing. It's the source of the money and the opportunities for all interest in the society to have their views represented.
Let me say, Tom and I have spent a lot of years working on campaign reform. We did a working group that had something to do with the McCain-Feingold law that passed, and we're quite proud of that. We were dismayed with the Citizens United decision, which demonstrates that the dysfunction and tribalism isn't just in Congress or in state legislatures. It's in the Supreme Court as well. And, you know, part of the problem we have is until you change the court, and you know, don't believe that this is the Constitution from on high. If Sandra Day O'Connor had not retired prematurely from the court, we wouldn't be in this position right now. It's also not just the court. It's a Federal Election Commission. It's now an IRS that isn't enforcing its own regulations. There are a lot of problems there, and they're deep ones. We are, and it's critical that we deal with them, because the level of corruption now is so much greater as a consequence of Citizens United. Anthony Kennedy must be living on a different planet not to realize that if you unleash corporations in unlimited sums directly into campaigns, say it's independent, but it's not, I can't tell you what's going on. I mean, we're right in the middle of it, and we see how much this is corrupting the process. It's the new Gilded Age, and then you see what's happening in the campaign now. $10 million from Joe Ricketts, but we've had Karl Rove's sham public welfare organization, American Crossroads GPS, that's going to spend $300 million on ads that are just basically attack ads, many of them for House and Senate races, but also in the presidential campaign, $25 million already allocated this week, most of it coming from huge contributions from undisclosed donors. And all of them have a tagline at the end, not associated with any campaign or candidate. So they can lie repeatedly and do outrageous things, and you get situations like the candidate saying, well, I have nothing to do with that. It's terrible. Maybe they'll run more of them. Yes. And that's no way to run a political system. And, you know, absent a change in the Supreme Court, we've got to try and find ways to energize agencies, to change those agencies. We've called on President Obama to use his recess appointment authority to replace five members of the Federal Election Commission whose terms have long expired. That alone would have a significant impact in creating a sense of enforcement of the rules. It's a necessary component. As Tom said, it's not everything. And believe me, there's no magic bullet in the money world. You're not going to suddenly have sweetness and light because you take private money out of campaigns. But leaving the system as it is a formula for utter disaster.
Or no change, certainly. But let me shift gears a little bit. We had a number of questions about political parties, and that's also a big component of your book. You talk about that. So let me read you some of the questions, and I'll put them together. Here's one from one of our audience members. The GOP has been far more adept at framing the issues, listening to its intellectuals who do this framing like Frank Luntz, than the Democrats. See if you agree with that or not. Assuming that only an electoral failure will restore the GOP, what messages do you think the Democrats need to put out before November?
You know, messaging does matter, certainly. And there were a couple of things about President Obama that have frustrated me on that front over the last 3 years. One was, I think he should have had a message that called on all of us to sacrifice right from the beginning. The failure to mobilize the public behind the idea that we are all in the same ocean liner together and all of us are going to have to do a little something now makes the traction dealing with what is clearly a real problem, a 1% and a 1/10 of 1% so out of touch with reality. And one of the things we use in the book and decry is Steve Schwartzman, the billionaire head of the Blackstone Group, who said that a proposal to increase the tax rate on the income for hedge fund operators from its 15% to what others pay is akin to Hitler invading Poland. I mean, if that's how you're going to react to sacrifice, where, you know, maybe you'll have to go down by $100 million from the billion you earn, God help us. But you'd have much more traction if the initial plea had been to call upon all of us to sacrifice. And at the same time, we need some clear talk about the realities of what's happened in the economy and what it's going to take to fix it that look at all the elements. I wish that President Obama a year ago had done a Ross Perot-type address to the nation with handmade charts. Here's where the economy was when I got elected. Here's where it was when I got inaugurated. Here's where we are now. Here's what we've done, but here's what we've got to do and what we all have to do. And I think he could have changed the conversation even around the Simpson-Bowles plan or just the template for how we deal with it. So all of those things matter. But I think we also put an inordinate amount of influence now when people like Frank Luntz and assume that they're Svengalis who somehow come up with these words that mesmerize or hypnotize people. It's much deeper in terms of the values that people have, and there's no magic bullet in messaging.
I don't think we have any comparative advantage in giving Democrats advice on how to frame the issues for the next campaign. Elections are driven by broad forces, and right now that's the economy. Every government in up for re-election since the great financial meltdown and recession has been tossed out of office, save one, Poland. Everybody else is gone, left, center, right. You're gone. It's the phenomenon, if things aren't going well, get rid of them and let's try something else. So Mr. Obama has himself a difficult situation. He inherited the worst economic conditions since the Great Depression. And in many respects, if you look at it, it sort of played out in the first months and then the momentum turned around and it's been growth and job creation. But it's pretty pathetic compared to what we want and what we need. People are suffering. And it's worse in Europe. And it's especially worse when policies of immediate austerity are imposed upon an economy that's lacking in demand. So one of the things they should do is simply tell the truth about what has happened, what occurred over the last 10 years. Explain it as clearly as they can. Get help from people who may be able to say it in much more concise terms than I can. I'm not very good at that. But I think if this election is simply about, are you happy with the pace of recovery from the Great Recession, you know, he's toast. But if it's about what's the alternative the other side is doing, okay, we're going to cut taxes really big. We're going to cut regulations and we're going to squeeze down on spending. And that means discretionary domestic spending, which as the share of the economy is now at about the level it was at under Dwight Eisenhower. You know, there is no inexorable growth of government. Just focus on what's important, what's serious, what's real, and do so in a way that you can get through to ordinary folks who aren't reading the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal every day. Right.
Just staying on those same themes for a moment, I think these were actually a couple of questions from the same individual, judging by the handwriting. But to give you a chance to reinforce the message that you opened with, which was we're calling out the Republican Party, but they both parties have done it. One of our listeners wrote tonight, you put much of the blame for a dysfunctional Congress on Republicans. Senate Democrats didn't pass a budget in over 1,000 days. Aren't Democrats just as responsible? And then I think the same person just made the same thing about the Simpson-Bowles Commission. recommendations for deficit reduction. And the audience member observes that the president ignored most of the commission's recommendations. And I think the implication of that is that's maybe some of what, if not enraged, is sort of a little gasoline on the fire for Republican response to that. So I guess the question is, should you have called out both parties?
Yeah, no, these, let me just level with you. These are talking points that are very familiar. Everyone's saying them. The almost exact same language sort of moves around. What was clear on the Simpson-Bowles front is that, first of all, it was supposed to be a commission set up by law. But at the last minute, Republican sponsors of that very commission, seeing that Obama endorsed it, decided to change their vote and uphold a filibuster that killed it. And so the president appointed this on his own and let it go about his work. He made a tactical decision about whether to embrace it. Remember, almost all of the Republicans on the commission voted against it, including all of the House members. So this was a tactical decision. He submitted a budget that incorporated much of what he did. But he finally learned a lesson after 2 years of trying to move toward his opposition and lure them into negotiations. As soon as he puts his name on something, the Republicans are against it. It's true of health care reform proposals, and it's true of deficit reduction proposals. The Gang of Six in the Senate went to work and announced the plan, and Obama said, that's really a great constructive move. I can get behind that. And the word in the Republican cloakrooms is, it's dead. Obama's for it. None of us are going to do it. That's what our politics is like now. There is no incentive now on the Republican side to engage in any such negotiations.
Let me ask you, though. President Clinton encountered after the 94 midterms and the Republican Revolution, remember, to take back control of the House, Newt Gingrich. We have questions about his political career, by the way, tonight, too. Similar circumstances, and yet through a policy of triangulation managed to triumph over it or to be effective to some degree with that. What did he do that the president's not doing now, or am I misstating the historical record on how effective?
Well, I think what happened is in the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, you had Republicans under Gingrich operating the same way, a parliamentary party. They voted against everything.
Yeah.
They hamstrung his economic plan. It took him 8 months to get it passed. Then, worked together to kill any health care reform. And they reaped the benefits in the 94 election. For the next year, you saw Gingrich and his Republicans try and destroy Clinton. And we led to the shutdown of the government at the end of 1995 and a backlash against the Republicans. Newt then went to his colleagues and said, I'm a historian. We won the House for the first time in 40 years. It's been 68 years since we won a second consecutive term. If we're going to stay in the majority, we got to work with this guy. Pragmatic decision and a willingness to throw Bob Dole under the bus to make it happen. And then you got a year of collaboration. Clinton won. The Republicans won. Before long, Newt was out, and Clinton was impeached. And by the way, we were well on the way to Social Security reform, and it was impeachment that killed that, among other things. So we can talk about that. Now, let me get back to the questions that were raised in a couple of ways. First, I do think that Obama made a tactical mistake. And I wish at his State of the Union message a year and a half ago, he had said, I have the Simpson-Bowles Commission. I don't agree with everything that they put together. None of us do. But I'm directing you in Congress to take that plan, turn it into legislative language, and then let's really go at how we solve this problem. I think it would have been a smart thing to do, and it was a mistake on his part. Tom is right. Anything that he did it because he thought if he endorsed it, it would be the kiss of death. Let me talk just for a minute. I would say Democrats have done plenty of things to hamstring Republican presidents and embarrass them. And there were moments when George W. Bush was getting whipped like a pinata on the Social Security issue, and reached out to the Democrats, and they said, we're going to stomp on your neck on this one. And, you know, it could have worked out differently. But if you look at the last 3 years, it's different. It's different than a Democratic Party that when George Bush came in under the worst circumstances imaginable, they could have killed his presidency right from the beginning. Instead, George Miller of California and Ted Kennedy worked with Bush to get the No Child Left Behind law enacted. Now, they may have liked some of those policies, but the fact is if they had acted tactically to kill it, George W. Bush would have started his presidency and would never have recovered from his inability to act. So they gave him a political present of enormous proportions. And then it carried through most of that presidency in a whole host of ways, including it was Democrats who bailed the president out on the bailout, right, on TARP, on the budget. A budget is not doesn't have the force of law. It's a resolution. Both houses pass it. Whether it passes or fails usually has no impact on fiscal policy. But what's also true is that we had a Budget Control Act, a law that was passed in the aftermath of the debt limit, which imposed a budget done not through a resolution that the president never signs, but a law for this year and the next, this fiscal year and the next. So the Senate has actually passed budgets for two fiscal years. So this is, as Tom said, a talking point that's out there that gets repeated on Fox News all the time. Lots of people hear it, and they just repeat it as evidence that they've done nothing, but it's simply an inaccurate
one. Not accurate. Okay. 4 minutes left. Two more questions, one for each of you from the audience. And I'm going to mix a couple of them. I had several about media. One about Rush Limbaugh, another about Fox, another about mainstream media. And the thrust of the questions, I think, was all the same. Are they part of the problem that needs addressing? The news summary, the news narrative.
Yes. next.
Yes.
So, in your book, describe quickly do you address that without violating the First Amendment?
And the answer is you're not going to violate the First Amendment. And a part of this is simply we're living in a world of where the technology is such that somehow a network with an audience at any given time of 2.5 million people can have more net profits than all three network news divisions with audiences of 30 million people combined. And it's because Roger Ailes is a really smart guy who found a business model that works and that keeps on giving. And if you look at MSNBC, it was on the trash heap, basically. Its parent, General Electric, was ready to give up on it. They developed a diluted version of that model on the other side. And now they're nowhere near where Fox is, but they're more valuable than NBC to Comcast, which owns them. So we've got Back to the Future. It's partisan media in a way we had in the 19th century, but with a breadth and depth and immediacy that is well beyond it. And the only way you can deal with it is not to punish them. They're doing what networks are supposed to do, what journalists do. They're out to make money and to build an audience. It's to try and create a public square so that you can actually have a place where people can go, where they can get not a spin, not or even what CNN with no particular business model provides, which is, as Tom said, somebody one end screaming at somebody at the other, or somebody spinning against somebody spinning, but straightforward media. That's what public media have done. We have to enhance it and expand it. And another way we've talked about it is creating a shadow Congress consisting of former members who are not part of the tribal wars now. They span the spectrum, but they'll start with a common set of facts and then debate, hammer and tong the issues that will enlighten instead of divide. And in small ways, maybe we can begin to guard against some of this dynamic.
Okay.
We're almost out. One of the great problems is so many Americans have views and they go to sources that reinforce those views. Americans move into neighborhoods of like-minded people. The more you surround yourself with people who agree with you, the more you'll never listen to an argument or a piece of evidence coming from the other side. That's a broad phenomenon. Media is a part of it, but not entirely. We've got to look for mechanisms of getting people to listen to one another. That's how our system works effectively.
You know, I have 30 seconds left. I think I'd rather just leave it on that note. I think you've covered most of it. They will be signing copies of their book out in the lobby when we're done. For those of you who didn't get your questions asked, I'll bet you could ask and they'll address it, not the least of which has to do with third parties, by the way. For our audience now, our thanks to Thomas Mann, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Norman Ornstein, Resident Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, who are co-authors of the new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. I also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet, and I want to remind you that copies of the speaker's new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, are on sale in the library, and, these two gentlemen will be pleased to sign books outside this room immediately following the program. And now, I'm Joe Tooman, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.